Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So here's some questions. What makes you a good person or a bad one? How do you choose between the devil or the angel on your shoulders? Essentially, what forms your moral compass?
Well, it could be how you were raised.
Or your faith.
Or the values of the society you live in.
But if you ask a neuroscientist, they'll likely tell you that morality has an even deeper, more fundamental origin than that. Researchers are finding that moral decision-making is a deeply biological process rooted in your brain.
That's the subject in the latest in our series, Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience. In a moment, we'll speak with a Harvard researcher who is investigating morality, the brain, and impulse control.
But first, let's turn to Carrie Goldberg, co-host of WBUR's Common Health blog. She reported today's story on neuroscience and morality. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
So what got you interested in this question to begin with?
Well, it started when I went to a neuroscience conference last fall, and I heard some actually local Boston-based researchers talking about this amazing experiment in which by stimulating a certain part of a monkey's brain, it's called the anterior cingulate, they could actually make the monkeys share less. So that kind of boggled my mind because it's this complex social behavior, and yet by using stimulation, they could change that behavior. And I just hadn't realized that neuroscience had gotten that far, that they were not just figuring out what parts of the brain were active in a behavior, but actually able to change them as well.
So it seems as if neuroscience is finding that there are actual neural underpinnings in our brain to these complex questions of responsibility and morality.
Right. And of course, that shouldn't be a surprise because everything we think and feel does originate in our brain.
And yet it does feel pretty surprising.
It does. And what was particularly surprising to me was that they can not only parse out different parts of the brain that are involved in different moral decisions or feelings, but they're also starting to be able to tweak them and show that it will change your moral decision or your behavior. So, for example, at Harvard, Joshua Buchholz is looking at how if you stimulate one part of your brain, you might be able to put off a reward. So we tend to want immediate rewards, you know, like give me that $20 now. But if this part of your brain is stimulated, you may be able to put off the $20 now in order to get $40 in 2 weeks. And the hope is that this may be able to help people who have problems with decision making.
Veterans with traumatic brain injuries, for example, they have terrible trouble weighing these cost-benefit kinds of decisions. And the impulsivity that you see in TBI patients, we think might come out of the fact that they're unable to keep in mind these long-term representations of cost and consequence when faced with immediate rewards.
So that seems to be one very meaningful use of this kind of research. But, Carrie, I keep going back to this question of morality. I'm struggling with it a bit because it feels like central to someone's character and not necessarily something that should be determined or manipulated by electrostimulation in the brain.
I know, Meghna, and I can make you struggle with it even more. I'm going to describe an experiment that's going on at Boston College where they're finding that they can even manipulate how you feel about your moral positions. For example, eating meat, is it wrong or is it right? Abortion, is it wrong or is it right? So at Boston College, the Morality Lab, which is led by Leanne Young, is showing that using electrical and magnetic stimulation, they can actually shift how people feel about their moral judgments.
People tend to think of moral judgments as very central to their character. So showing people that their judgments and that their perceptions are flexible when it comes to morality, that's pretty striking, I think.
So this all brings us back to this big question that I feel like requires us to take our focus out of the lab and into society as a whole, because doesn't this naturally lead to a world where we say, I'm not responsible for my actions, don't blame me, blame the wiring in my brain?
Right. I'm wired wrong. It's not my fault. So I think that's the inevitable question that comes from this. And it was actually kind of torturing me as I was doing this reporting. So I kept asking these neuroscientists and they kept saying, that's not our job. You know, you need to go talk to a philosopher. So I did. I spoke with Daniel C. Dennett, who's a Tufts professor of philosophy, and he's dealt with these issues a lot. And he has a kind of a commonsensical approach.
If you do something on purpose and you know what you're doing and you did it for reasons good, bad, or indifferent, then your brain made you do it, of course. And it doesn't follow that you were not the author of that deed. Why? Because you are your embodied brain.
So what do you think, Meghna? Is that convincing that you are your embodied brain and therefore if you know what you're doing, you're responsible?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty convincing, but I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about the implications of this research, in my mind.
And in philosophy in general. I mean, this is a live question right now.
But Carrie, I'm curious, let me throw this question back at you. How has reporting this story changed how you feel about the question of responsibility, blame, etc.?
Well, actually, one thing that helped me the most was seeing that there was a recent paper that came out in the journal Psychological Sciences that found that, in general, people, when they learn about the neuroscience, it tends to make them be oriented a little more towards practical aspects of punishment. So, for example, if this person is unsafe, let's not let him out on the street, as opposed to retribution, like this person did wrong, let's punish him, you know. So neuroscience tends to lead us a little bit away from that kind of retribution because we have more of a sense that this isn't totally maybe quite as voluntary or conscious as we might have thought when we didn't understand the brain mechanisms as well, and towards a more practical and possibly more constructive approach in which we say, all right, we're not out to punish you. To some extent, this is the brain you were born with, but we do have to deal with you.
WBUR's Carrie Goldberg talking to us about her story on morality and neuroscience. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, listeners, we want to hear from you. What's your reaction to this research, to the idea that morality might be a deep-seated function of how our brains work rather than maybe how we were raised or our faith? What kind of questions does it raise for you? We'll be talking to a couple of professors from the Boston area who are doing cutting-edge research on this. So give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, Carrie Goldberg mentioned Joshua Buchholz. He's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard University. He's been doing a lot of research on moral decision-making and impulse control, and he joins us right now in the studio. Joshua Buchholz, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So I want to just first start by asking you what might just seem to be a deliberately gauche question, but I'm genuinely curious. When talking to someone like you or a neuroscientist, what is morality to you in your field? What does a neuroscientist think morality is?
In some sense, that's not a question that's appropriate for me. Yeah. I am a neuroscientist, and I can tell you how the brain processes information. And I can also tell you how failures in different kinds of information processing produce different kinds of behavior that we can see, like violence and drug addiction and other forms of antisocial behavior. The normative question of what is moral and immoral behavior, that's something that's constructed after people have these brain information processing failures. So in a very important sense for me, the question of, you know, where is morality in the brain is not really a question that's appropriate for the level of analysis that I do.
Right. So let me rephrase, because I take your point. I didn't mean to ask you, like, what do you think is moral and what is not. But when people say that they're looking to understand how morality is affected or enacted in our brain systems, what are you looking at?
So we're looking at several different kinds of failures, right? If we were going to construct neuroscientifically the most immoral, the most antisocial individual we could possibly imagine, there are a few tweaks we would make to the way that that person processes different kinds of information. We would make them hypersensitive to very immediate rewards. We would make them insensitive to future consequences and costs that are associated with their behavior. We would tamp down their empathic response to other people's pain and, in general, their pro-social motivations and sentiments. We would also short-circuit their emotion regulation capacities. And when you put these different information processing failures together in a single person, what you get is invariably going to be what we recognize as immoral or antisocial behavior, because these are the things that people need to behave in ways that accord with the social norms that over tens of thousands of years we've learned help society work a lot better.
Mm. So tell us what research has found so far in terms of are there specific areas of the brain that tend to have a greater role in regulating these processes?
Sure. So each of these processes has a brain network that's associated with them. And when we look at antisocial people, violent people, people who engage in what we would think of as immoral behavior, we can see deficits in these brain information processing circuits that are associated with these different capacities for emotion regulation, cost-benefit decision-making, and empathic response.
Mm. So are these, so tell us a little bit more about the particular experiments that you have been able to do in the lab. I mean, in Carrie's piece, which aired on WBR this morning, we got a hint of it, but I'd love to hear more about how you're actually testing, you know, ways to make changes in the brain that have a different outcome when it comes to empathic response or impulse control.
So the thing that we're most focused on are these cost-benefit decisions that involve people weighing the value of a short-term reward against the long-term consequences of getting that short-term reward. And we know from exquisite neuroscience work that's been done in the last 20 years, some of the brain circuits that seem to be involved in that ability. And what we're doing is using a technique called transcranial direct current stimulation to upregulate the function of one of these circuits in hopes that we can make the costs and consequences of behavior a little bit more salient for people, and that is going to affect the way that they make decisions.
Mm. And so how do you do that?
So in its most sort of simple, gross sense, direct current stimulation involves taking a big battery, attaching a wire to one end of it and a wire to the other end of it, attaching sponges to the wires and putting them on people's brains. Now, it's a lot safer and more complicated than that. But in essence, what we're doing is passing a very weak electrical current through the skull. And it travels through the skull and then has effects on the populations of neurons that lie in the cortex right underneath that part of the skull.
Okay. And have you seen dramatic differences when you are able to do that?
The work that we're doing right now is ongoing. But there are other research groups that have shown, you know, I don't want to overstate the magnitude of these effects because these processes are complicated and you're never going to have, you know, a silver bullet that, you know, immediately and inexorably solves these kinds of information processing deficits. Yeah. But the work that's been done so far is pretty compelling.
Now, I'm just curious about how much we know so far about whether or not some of these, and I'm going to keep going back to the word moral because
sure.
It's just, it's a shorthand way of describing what this research is looking at, but how much of this moral decision-making is sort of wired in us from the moment of conception, from the time we're born, versus it being, you know, it being shaped over time on who we are, what our experiences are, on the very decisions that we make that might affect our brains in other ways.
Sure. So if I hear you right, what you're asking is a sort of nature-nurture question.
Nature-nurture, chicken, egg, whatever you want to call it.
So we're born with a particular set of genes and genetic variants that constrain the way that our brains process information from birth. Now, brains are incredibly plastic. They're very sensitive to the environments that they're exposed to. So you're going to get predispositions and biases in the way that brains process information that are due to the genetic load that a person is born with. But these are not deterministic. You can still get environments, particularly early life upbringing, has a tremendous impact on these brain circuits. And so I don't want to overstate the fact that because there is a genetic component to these behaviors, that they are determined in a way that is, frankly, depressing, because brains one thing that we know about brains is they are incredibly sensitive to the things that happen to the person who have those brains, right? The environments that they're exposed to, the parents that they get, the social supports that they have. And there is this constant and dynamic back and forth between the genetic predispositions that people have and the environments that they're exposed to. Genes don't control behavior. They bias people to have certain kinds of information processing, but the brain circuits that are involved are incredibly susceptible to later in life environmental exposures.
Right. So Josh Buchholz, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard University, stand by for just a moment. We're talking about morality and neuroscience and what neuroscience has to tell us about where morality comes from in the human brain. Josh Buchholz, as I said, is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard. He's with us. Joining us now is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a professor of psychology at Northeastern University. Her area of research focuses on an equally thorny aspect of human life, that is emotion, and she's got a lot to say about morality as well. Lisa Feldman Barrett, welcome back to the program.
Hi there.
It's great to have you. So let me ask you, I mean, on the point that Josh just made, that there are multiple factors that go into shaping anyone's sense of, you know, morality as we might see it play out in the brain. I mean, what are the implications for that for how we're going about doing this neuroscience research?
Well, I think right now the way that we do research on brain processes is pretty much constrained by the methods that we have available. And what I mean by that is we usually bring people into the laboratory and we present stimuli or situations to them in a highly controlled and somewhat, you know, impoverished kind of experimental setup. So the context is highly controlled, and we experiment in very constrained circumstances. And that's really useful for studying how brain systems work in a certain context. But one of the things that we learned from genetics, work on genetics, is that when you're studying genes, for example, in a certain context, it doesn't necessarily generalize to all other contexts. One of the things we know, for example, was that sequencing the human genome didn't tell us everything that we needed to know. That the molecular configuration of our genes alone, as Josh explained, doesn't really tell us about how they contribute to behavior. We need to know how they interact with the environment, or what is called epigenetics, to really understand, you know, how behavior arises. And the same is also probably true for how the brain works.
I mean, is it not possibly more true? Because, I mean, when we're talking about things like morality or emotion, I mean, it seems to me these things by definition require the context of society, of our families, of the people who surround us to help even understand what it is we're talking about when we're speaking of good or bad.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, we heard Dan Dennett say, you know, you are your brain, and you are your brain, but you are your brain, which is held in your body in a context of other brains being held in other bodies. And so, you know, we tend to think of ourselves in this highly individualistic way, but really, you know, we're functioning always in a context. And so when we measure people independent of the context, or let's say only in a single context, really what we're learning about is how the brain works in that single context.
Right. Josh Buchholz, you have a response to that?
I'll say something that I say a lot, which is I agree totally with Lisa. you know, the point that something as complicated, as multifactorial as moral behavior can't be reducible to one single thing like genetics is really important. You know, we have genetic factors, we have individual environmental factors, we have community factors, we have social factors, we have cultural factors. All of these things act through the brain to produce behavior, but we can't ignore the effects of these other higher order factors.
Right. So this is getting me to the point where I want to ask a whole series of questions, which I know maybe neither of you will want to engage in, because it makes me wonder, you know, over time, as this research does emerge from the lab and out into society, I mean, what do we do with it if everything is so highly variable, given, you know, people's neurological makeup, the background they come from, the choices that they've made in their lives? I mean, how can we put this research to best use, Lisa Barrett?
Well, I think what I hear, Meghna, you asking is actually two questions, really. I mean, one question is, how do we do it? It's so complex. How do we actually even get it done? And I think sometimes people feel it's so complex, you know, why even bother to do it, or it just seems impossible to do. And I think that's, you know, not the right approach at all. I think it's remarkable the strides that scientists have made computationally, experimentally. You know, we really are on the road to bridging the lab and the world, and to being able to do some pretty remarkable modeling. So, you know, we probably are less than a generation away from being able to do the kinds of studies that will allow us to see how brains function in the real world. The second part of your question, though, what use do we put them to? I think that's, you know, only partially a question to scientists, and partially it's a question to other types of social commentators and critics. You know, to a scientist, I think, like myself, or maybe Josh will agree, I like it when he agrees. you know, I think for us, we put it to the use of trying to understand, to explain how mental states and behaviors arise in, you know, within a brain in the context of other brains. But using that to regulate society seems, you know, fraught with problems and difficulties. And frankly, if you look at the history of science, it usually goes in the other direction. It's usually the social beliefs and standards usually dictate scientific theories rather than the other way around.
Right. Well, Josh Buchholz, let me just, we have just enough time for me to throw the final question to you. For people listening to this who might come at it and still feel a little uncomfortable with this idea that science can sort of, or is trying to decipher and understand the neural underpinnings of morality in our brain, in our brains, what would you tell them to make them more comfortable? Maybe just, like, you know, deal with it. We are our brains.
I wouldn't say it as harshly as that. I will say that the more that we even have the slightest increase in an understanding of this complicated process, the better off we're going to be. Even in the last 30 years, as our understanding of neuroscience has increased, we have dramatic changes in the justice system. We have the Supreme Court making decisions about juvenile justice, not on the basis exactly of neuroscience, but incredibly informed by neuroscientific understandings of brain development. So I would argue that this is a really good thing that's happening. The more that we understand about brains and how plastic they are and how they develop, the more there is a potential for, you know, fairness and a better justice system, for example. So this is a good thing. I understand that it's scary to you know, take something as mysterious and seemingly deep-seated and holding it up to the bright light of empirical science, but this is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, both of you have got us off to a great start when it comes to having this conversation about neuroscience and morality. Looks like we're gonna have to turn to historians and philosophers next to see what to do when it comes out of the lab and into society. Josh Buchholz, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, great to have you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Lisa Feldman-Barrett, Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's more of the show coming up in just a minute, so stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.